like kind of the first step in your education. And in it, you were really just trying to memorize and learn the Torah. You know, thinking like, you know, this is a society that is largely oral. If you were in a synagogue that was like rich, you might have multiple books or letters in the Old Testament. Many times they might have one copy of the Torah for the synagogue. So they needed to memorize, they needed to know the Word of God. And so when they were young, they would try to memorize it. And if you were an exceptional student and did a really good job, you would get to about the time you're probably around 10, they would actually have memorized the first five books of the Bible. Can you imagine that? Now, most people after that would go off and become carpenters and fishermen and, you know, what have you. But if you were really good and you had capacity, maybe your family had the capacity to let you keep doing your education, and you were talented enough at this, that you would keep going to the next school, which was called Beit Talmud. Beit Talmud was basically where you started learning the rest of what we call the Old Testament, everything from Genesis to Malachi. And they're trying to memorize this. You know, some of you guys are like, I feel good about myself if I read the whole Bible by the time I graduate college. They're memorizing the entire Old Testament in that time. And afterwards, then they would go off and become, you know, fishermen or carpenters or what have you. But if you were the best of the best, if you were the most talented, the most capable, the most connected, you might be able to go become a disciple. And your job was basically, you had to convince some rabbi to take you under their wing, and to basically you would go up to the rabbi, say, hey, I want to be your disciple. The rabbi would quiz you on different questions, thoughts, comments on theology, to see if they thought you could, and this is how they said it, bear their yoke. And their yoke was this idea of, this is what I understand is how you interpret the Torah, this is how we live out the Torah, this is my interpretation of obeying the laws of God in the world. And when Jesus says things like, hey, my yoke is easy, my burden is light, he's referencing the idea, me as a rabbi, I am saying my yoke is easy, my burden is light, you can do this. And Jesus changes the whole game. Because where a disciple needed to be the best of the best, Jesus comes up to these guys like tax collectors and fishermen, and they are tax collectors and fishermen because they were not good enough to be a disciple. And Jesus comes up to them, and where a disciple is supposed to pursue the rabbi and convince the rabbi that they're good enough, Jesus pursues them and says, I know you are. The people who thought they weren't good enough, Jesus says, you can do this. You can carry my yoke. You can do like what I do in this world. And you are good enough. I'm going to pursue after you. Because that's the story of Jesus, is that he pursued us even when we didn't know, want, or understand how to pursue after him. And so we have this idea of how Jesus is pursuing after these disciples. And so this was this would have been an incredibly humbling, honoring situation. That these guys, there's a reason why these guys all seem like they're willing to give up everything to follow after Jesus. Right? Let alone this guy who's being like whispered maybe is the Messiah, like this great rabbi. Like there's this idea of there's this incredible honor, and that would have been a humbling moment for any one of them, for somebody to say, I believe in you that much. And so I want to look at tonight this idea of John, because at the end of John's life, the Gospel of John was written by John, is written years later from the other Gospels. He is the last disciple that's alive. He knows what the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, and Luke have written. So he's articulating something very different. He's kind of highlighting other aspects of Jesus' life and ministry. And here he is looking at Jesus on the cross. And in the lens of looking at Christ, now he in the moment didn't understand what was going on. But later on in his life, reflecting throughout his life on what Jesus' sacrifice really meant, looks at Jesus and says, I cannot even look at myself in this moment without looking at myself through the lens of this is the one who loves me this much. And so throughout his gospel, he says, he calls himself the one whom Jesus loves, because he cannot see himself. There is no sense of identity unto himself without seeing that sacrifice, who he is, what he has become. The transformation in his life is so complete, so transformative, that in the moment of looking back on that moment and how his thought life must have been affected, because he was there in that moment looking at Jesus on the cross saying, this is the one, this is God incarnate, this is God become man, dying for me, and I am looking upon his face and saying, this is a sacrifice so great because of a love so profound. And so he goes throughout his gospel, and there's this general sense that he is, that he never names himself as kind of an act of humility on his part by naming his gospel, just kind of saying, this is the guy who Jesus loves. And so this humility that John has throughout his life, that he was called to be a disciple when he shouldn't have been, that even though in the middle of his youngness, you know, his young years, he dabbled with pride and ego, you see at the end of his life, he comes back to that place of saying, I cannot even look at myself without seeing myself through Jesus' eyes. What does that look like, and how does that transform us in our faith? So I want to look at, just for a few minutes, three things about humility. Why do we need it? What is it? And how do we receive it? Why do we need humility in our life? Why is there power in that? Why is humility critical? What is humility? Because it's not what you typically think. And how do we receive it? So let's ask first, why do we need it? Sometimes the easiest way to describe the necessity of something is by looking at the attributes of its opposite. And when we talk about humility, what's the opposite of humility? Pride, right? So let's talk about pride for a minute. Pride is four things tonight. Pride is four things. Why we need humility is because pride is, one, fragile. I'm going to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 3. I'm going to read this, and we're going to kind of bank here for a little while tonight. But in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, starting in verse 21, it says, Paul talking to this church in Corinth, he says, so then, no more boasting about human leaders. There's these different people in the church. They're like, hey, I was like mentored by Paul. And others are like, I came to the Lord when Apollos was here, which was this other leader. Paul respects him. There's this like, but these people in the church are starting to fracture under this conversation about who was your, you know, mentor, who discipled you, so to speak. And there's this division in the church. So he says, hey, no more about this human leader stuff. All things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas, which is another leader, or the world, or life, or death, or the present, or the future, all are yours, and you are of Christ, and Christ is of God. Okay, this then is how you ought to regard us, as servants of Christ, and as those entrusted with the mysteries of God that has been revealed. Now, it is required that those who have been given a trust must prove faithful. I care very little if I am judged by you, or by any human court. Kind of a bold statement saying from a man who is speaking from prison, about to go see the leader of the known world at that time. You know, that he's like, I don't care. I don't care if people are going to judge me. I don't care if you do. I don't care if the courts do. I don't care if Caesar does. Indeed, I do not even judge myself. That's really interesting. My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent. It is the Lord who judges me, therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait until the Lord comes. He will bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of the heart. At that time, each will receive their praise from God. Now, brothers and sisters, I have applied these things to myself and Apollos for your benefit, so that you may learn from us the meaning of the saying, do not go beyond what is written. Then you will not be puffed up in being a follower of one of us over against the other. For who makes you different from anyone else? You know, I was discipled by Brent. I was discipled by Jacob. I'm better. I'm better. Like, I don't care. We don't care. Are you following God? What do you have that you did not receive? So why are you so proud? And if you did receive it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it from someone else? Okay, now a couple things. Remember, we're talking about, I know it's kind of a longer passage there, but we are talking about pride is fragile. And in verse 6, I'm going to kind of keep going back to this passage here tonight, but 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6, he says, then you will not be puffed up in being a follower of one of us over against the other. Now, some of your translations will say pride, puffed up. It actually, in the Greek, isn't even the word for like hubris, which is typically the word that we think of for pride, but it's actually a very unique word. He uses it in 1 Corinthians. He uses it, I think, once in Colossians, and that's it. And commentators have highlighted it was kind of a special theme of Paul's, because this word, and I'm going to butcher it, but it is phuseo-o in the Greek, and that word it's a very pictorial word, and it has this imagery of an organ in the human body that is bloated and full of air or pus, and it's getting out of size. It's getting bigger than it should, and it's causing a lot of pain, and it's in fear of rupture. Right? Okay. So it's very provocative. It's very it's just this word that's very strange. And when I was a few years ago now, Preston, when he was born, it was 3 years ago. The week before he was born, I started feeling this pain in my stomach. And I was so busy, I was trying to get everything done and ready to go on paternity leave. And I was just like, it's fine, it's no big deal, it's just got this little pain. And I went through this whole week leading up to it, and finally it was the weekend, man, I really should probably go see a doctor about this. But I was the clinic I go to is closed, so I was I'll go Monday morning. And of course, how things go, 5 a.m. Monday morning, Lindsay wakes up, says, hey, we're going to the doctor. We're having a baby today. So I'm like, okay, going to the doctor, not for me. So we go, we have Preston, and everything's good. And I'm in the hospital for a couple of days, but of course, I don't think about going and getting anything checked. So I'm just there, I'm focused on Preston and Lindsay, and I'm just kind of there. And we get back, we get home, and my mother-in-law's there, and I keep saying, man, I still feel kind of pain in my stomach, it just won't go away. I thought it was dehydrated or something, but she's like, you really should go get that checked. I'm like, I'll worry about it tomorrow. She's like, no, you really should probably. I'm here, go to the doctor. Well, it was late. I said, okay, so I have to go to the ER. So I go to the ER, and the nurses there, they're trained to basically keep you calm and, to just be, keep everything cool, not to make you feel stressed out. So I'm just kind of whatever. And they're like, so what are your symptoms? And they're like, I don't know, I explained, and they said, hey, it sounds like an appendicitis, but how long have you had this? I'm like, well, it's about 2 weeks now. They're like, oh, no, it's not that. It's got to be some other gallstone or something like that. They're like, no big deal, it'll be fine. I'm like, okay. So they're starting doing some tests on me. Well, they do this ultrasound, and they're like, there's something in there that's I'm not even sure what organ that is, but they're like,
okay, that's not great. That was an extra organ.
So they're like, it's fine. I don't know what I'm looking at here. So we're just waiting for the blood test. And it was incredible. These nurses went, all of a sudden we got the blood test back and everything changed in an instant. They went from these cordial, nice, gentle, civil women all around me to these war-hardened medic on the front line type doctors, and they're throwing me on a gurney, running me down the hall to the surgery room. I barely have room to call Lindsay hey, I have an appendicitis, I'm going to the surgery, bye. And they're they put me under, they call Lindsay, the doctor literally calls Lindsay, he's like, it's bad, it's really bad, I'm going to do everything I can. She's like, everything you can? What are you talking about? It's an appendicitis. My appendix, and this is over grotesque, but typically it's supposed to be the size of your pinky. It was the size of a large sausage dog. It had gotten so big that it was in fear of rupturing during the surgery. It actually couldn't even get it all out without it creating an infection in part. People talk about men having sympathy weights. I had sympathy pains. I'm like, I'm birthing something. And we were quite a pair, Lindsay recovering from her birth and me recovering from my birth. But this is the imagery of Paul. This is the imagery of Paul. He is saying there is something in you. Your pride is like an organ that is about to burst and is going to destroy you. And this is why is the overinflated, that it is an imagery to say, man, this thing is in pain. That it is constantly giving attention to itself. It's fragile. It is constantly saying, hey, there is something wrong, because it is puffing itself up. It is building itself up. And if you think about it, what are you building yourself up with? typically in our society today, it's with self, which is this weird like circle of like, I'm filling myself with myself, but all you're filling yourself with is air. There's nothing. What is self? What is there's a definition of self, and where do you find value through that kind of cyclical reasoning? And so here is Paul, and he's saying, you are puffing yourself up about nothing that matters, nothing that's going to give you value. Yeah, who has, Paul is their, who wouldn't want Paul as their, family line, and LTC guys doing like your hair, you're like, yeah, I go to Jesus in two generations, it's like, that's really cool. But he's like, it's nothing. It doesn't do anything for you, and it's creating pain in your life. The other thing, well, Timothy Keller, I'll say this, in The Freedom of Self-Forgetfulness, I'm kind of referencing some of thoughts from that book. It's a great little book, super short, it's almost like a sermon, but he said, you often only notice a body part when it's hurt. You notice how you don't notice your toes until right now when I said it, and every one of you just wiggled your toes. Like, okay, yeah, they're doing okay. Because you don't notice things. Typically, you don't notice your body when it's not hurting. The fact that your body keeps, the fact that your ego keeps telling you, hey, I need to be fed, I need to be cared for, I just got hurt by that person, is so sensitive, is because it is not in the way that it was meant to be. It is bloated. It is in fear of rupture. It's often hurt or anxious because it's overinflated. It keeps sending signals that it's under duress or demanding attention because it is not healthy. It is bloated. It is not as if it was intended to be, and if we don't do something about it, it may destroy us. Two, it's exhausting. I promise these ones will be a little bit shorter, but it's exhausting. The problem with pride is that it cannot appreciate things for their own sake. Pride cannot appreciate things for their own sake. Rather, everything is a question of how does it help feed this thing that is hurting? How does it feed my sense of self? Pride is incapable of love because it uses the care of the other to feed itself and gives nothing in return, unless as an empty facade for the sake of keeping the other acting out expressions of love. Pride is intrinsically connected to comparing and boasting. And you don't care that you get good grades, you care that you got better grades than the other guy because you want to boast, you want to compare, I'm better than you because. And when we keep doing that, it is exhausting to live that way. It is exhausting to live under that facade and that need to keep feeding. You don't care that you get good grades, you don't care you got better grades. You don't care that you have, say you have money someday and you're rich, you care that you're richer than the other guy. Living this way is that every interaction, every connection that you have is an action that is feeding that need from that pain. So you're never fully present, because you are constantly filtering everything through if this hurts or doesn't hurt, if this helps, my ego. You become a slave to what feeds your ego, and it is a cruel and insatiable taskmaster. Third, it is destructive. For the same reason pride is exhausting, it is also destructive. You cannot selflessly choose for the highest good of another, because you are selfishly choosing for everything. You may find relationships for a time that are mutually beneficial, and so you start a friendship, but inevitably you will need more than the other, or the other will need more from you than you get out of it. And in that moment, your pride will say, this is no longer feeding me, and I'm out. And you move on.
Wow.
Maybe you will find an area of contention where your sense of self and the other sense of self are at odds, like in the Corinthian church, right? I had Ileana as my discipler. I had Lindsay as my discipler. Well, who's better? Like, we're fighting. About what? There's this sense of self, of ego, of pride that puffs itself up. And it's amazing how many wars and how much human suffering and how many church divisions have been caused throughout history because of the ego. It is highly destructive. Fourthly, it is hard soil. When Jesus talks about the soils, he references one that is a hard soil to receive the gospel. And when pride is involved, it hardens the heart, because pride is something that basically says, I want to be God, and it does not understand that God is God and you are not. It refuses to bend its knee because it is constantly trying to build itself up beyond what it was meant to be.
Yeah.
And so it is hard soil. Andrew Murray has this famous little book called Humility.
Yeah.
It is a short book, but I promise you it'll take you longer than you realize, because every page you're like, okay, I have to repent, so I don't have to come back to it. This pride, he says in this little book, pride must die in you, or nothing of heaven can live. Wow. Humility is the place of entire dependence on God. That entire dependence on God is, from the very nature of things, the first duty and the highest virtue of the creature, and the root of every virtue. And so, pride, or the loss of this humility, is the root of every sin and evil. If you think about it, you know, you can think of humility as a metaphor to, like, reading in education. Just because you know how to read doesn't mean that you're an engineer or a teacher or an accountant. But if you do not know how to read, you are not going to get very far in those fields, right? It is a baseline. It is an assumed necessity for all other things. And when we talk about faith, there is this idea, what Andrew Murray is getting at, is when you have humility, every potential in faith is open to you. Every lesson, every teaching, every capacity of the human experience with God is available to you. But when pride is in the way, each one of those is closed. Each potential is closed. Each opportunity, each ability is closed. Now, at this point, I should mention that humility is not typically what we think of when we think of that word. And it is broader, it is deeper, it is richer than what the typical cultural perception of it is. So let's talk about what is humility, this thing that we so desperately need. Paul here makes these funny references in 1 Corinthians. He says, "My conscience is clear, but that does not make me innocent." There's another time where he says, "I am the chief of sinners." Like, have you ever killed a Christian? Have you ever persecuted the church? Guess what? I've been there, done that. So I'm, you know, on the comparison game, you want to compare, you want to, you know, do the whole pride thing? Guess what? I win on the, like, negative side of, like, I am the worst, right? I suck. But on the same time, he is this man of incredible confidence and assurance and resilience. Like, where does that come from? And he says, "I don't care if you judge me. I don't care what I think of me. I don't care what you think of me. I don't care what I think of me." Like, how does that even make sense? In our society, we tend to think one of the biggest issues in humanity's woes, so to speak, in our culture, is a lack of self-esteem. There is this concept that if only we had higher self-esteem, then everything would be okay. But the reason why people, you know, why they're suffering, why people may, you know, do bad things, do drugs, and, you know, abuse their spouses or things, that's all because they have low self-esteem. If they only had higher self-esteem, they would feel better about themselves, they wouldn't do those things. Studies have shown that's actually not true. But our society is built on that, so much so that research, there was one New York Times article that basically said it's going to take years for our society to catch up to what the research has said, because we are so ingrained with the idea that what we need, we like this idea because what it tells us is we do not need to make a moral judgment about our culture. We simply need to say, you're awesome, and everything will be okay. Wow. But on the flip side, culturally, traditionally, throughout history, it has been the opposite. Yeah. The idea that the cause of humanity's woes is too high a sense of self-esteem, that we need to be, as culturally, what the world says, as humbled. And that's what we're going to try and get at, is actually this is not what the Christian concept is either. That what typically society has often said is the reason for these issues is we have too high a view of ourselves. We need to be, and this, you know, I can't even say it without saying it. I need to be humbled, right? I need to be, like, you know, cut down a notch, so to speak, right? Like, and if I did that, then everything would be okay. But Paul here says, I don't care what you think of me. I don't care what I think of me. Like, I'm not playing your game. I'm not doing either. So if I cannot find self-esteem from either elevating it or lowering it, where does esteem come from if not the self? And this is where C.S. Lewis, in his famous chapter on humility in Mere Christianity, says this: "Do not imagine that if you met a really humble man, he would be what most people call humble nowadays. He will not be a sort of greasy, smeary person who is always telling you that, of course, he is nobody. Probably all you would think about him is that he seemed to be a cheerful, intelligent chap who took a real interest in what you said to him. If you do dislike him, it will be because you feel a little envious of anyone who seems to enjoy life so easily. He will not be thinking about humility. He will not be thinking about himself at all. And C.S. Lewis is quoting, really kind of expounding upon one of his favorite authors who said, humility is not thinking less of oneself, it is thinking of oneself less. And so here Paul is saying, hey, I don't care what you think about me. I don't care what I think about me. I think I'm a horrible person, or I have been a horrible person. Without God, I think I am a horrible person. But you know what? I can be self-assured, I can be confident, and I can live in the freedom of Christ because my sense of esteem is not from self, it is from Christ. And here is John looking at Jesus on the cross and saying, this is why I cannot look at myself without seeing the love of Christ in my life. Because here is the one who has given me such esteem, such sense of value, such sense of significance. And humility is one part emptying and one part filling. And traditionally, there's been many religions and philosophies throughout the world that have gone on one side of that or the other. It's emptying, you know, oneself. If you think of, like, say, Buddhism, it's largely emptying oneself because there's nothing that they could find in the world that was worthy of filling yourself back with. It just led to a philosophical belief that you should just keep emptying until there's nothing, the snuffing out of the lamp or the candle, that nothing. This was a goal. But Jesus says, no, it's about emptying yourself of your pride, but filling yourself up with my identity over you. Yeah. Filling yourself with this sense of value and worth. And when we do that, we have this incredible ability to be humble while strong, humble while capable, humble while, as Paul was a man of great faith. You know, we know this guy, Daniel Savala, who it's kind of a mentor for somebody that was one of my mentors in life. And Daniel said, you know, my goal when I talk to somebody is not for them to walk away and say, boy, Daniel is so godly and so kind and so wise. And so he's like, that is a horrible motive. He said, my goal, and the crazy thing is he actually meant it and it was actually true in his life. But he said, when I hang out with somebody, my goal is that they would walk away and say, man, God is so good to my life. God is so amazing. How has he done this for me? He's like, I don't care if they remember me. I don't want them to remember me. I want them to remember Christ.
Yeah.
And there is this place of filling ourselves to a place where suddenly we are no longer focused on ourselves, but focused on him.
Yeah.
So lastly, how do we do that? How do we receive this? And John sees Jesus on the cross, and he says, here is where myself lies. Looking at the world through his eyes. Looking at myself through his eyes. If you remember last week, we talked about the four loves briefly. These old Franciscan monks who said, you know, we tend to start in a world with loving myself for my sake. Then we move to loving God for my sake, what I get out of it. Then we come to this place of loving God for his sake, his intrinsic worth and value becomes real to us. And then lastly, we come to this place of loving myself for his sake. And this shift we suddenly see in John's eyes as he's looking at himself and saying, man, I cannot see anything but my Lord and the love he has for me on the cross. This is the expression, ultimate expression of true love. All right. There's this guy, Thomas, is it Chalmers? I always forget how to say his last name. But he had this incredible teaching called the expulsive power of a new affection. And he says it this way. He says, seldom do any of our habits or flaws disappear by a process of extinction through reasoning or by the mere force of mental determinism. Reason and willpower are not enough, but what cannot be destroyed may be dispossessed. The only way to dispossess the heart of an old affection is by the expulsive power of a new one. I'm going to kind of jump down just a little bit. He basically starts talking about, you know, if you take a guy and and he can give up his desire for wealth by taking on his desire for beauty, or you know, you can dispossess. And actually, they're finding, they have found in psychology, they have said at times that habits almost can never be destroyed. They can only be displaced. Wow. Like, you can't lose the habit of alcoholism. You can displace it with something that's more healthy, like finding your way of coping with issues in life, with relationships. So you displace that. And what he's kind of getting at is this idea that your affections, the affections in your heart, cannot necessarily be destroyed by rational thought. Like, okay, I should not desire that. I should not want that. I should not be motivated by that. I know, you know, intellectually that, you know, this is not good for me, or this isn't healthy for me, or this is not how God designed me to be. But if I do not have a new affection, greater than the affection that I have for said thing, I'll never win the war. But he goes on, its desire for one particular object may be conquered, but its desire for having some one object of absolute love is unconquerable. It is only when admitted into the number of God's children through the faith that is in Christ Jesus that the spirit of adoption is poured out upon us. It is then that the heart, brought under the mastery of one great and predominant affection, is delivered from the tyranny of the former desires in the only way that deliverance is possible. Wow. He's basically saying we are being called to fill our life with Christ. And when we come to this place of seeing Christ, everything in his, in enraptured by his presence, by his love, by his, what he has done for us, when you realize he is all powerful, then it becomes easy to not live in the worries of this life. When you realize that he is perfectly good, it is easy to trust him. When you suddenly realize that your value as his child is greater than anything you could achieve in your striving in this life, it is easy to sit at his feet and not strive for self-fulfillment. But do we believe it? Are we enraptured by Christ? Have we come to this place of having a new affection, having a new love, and coming to this place of humility to say, God, I want you over my pride? And so here's just a couple practical thoughts as we start wrapping things up here. But what are a couple practical things, practical steps to walking out humility, of accepting this, becoming in our lives receptive to the spiritual pursuit of Christ in our life? And one is honor. Honor people. There is something about honor that when you honor, it, pride will never allow you to honor. Because pride says your goal is always to be comparing and to be better. So to honor is to lift someone up. And maybe they're going to be as good as you or even better than you in your eyes. And that is never allowed in pride. So when you say, hey, I'm going to just honor the things of Christ I see in you, you are making, taking a step to say, God, I am going to see people through your eyes, not my own. I am going to live in my humility, not in my pride. And so when we honor, it kills pride. It suffocates pride because it cannot survive in the midst of that. The other one is we need to meditate on how much you have been forgiven for Christ, by his sacrifice. Those who have been forgiven much love much, Jesus says. The funny thing is, if you think about it, Jesus was offering love or offering forgiveness to anyone, everyone. So who is, you know, who has been forgiven much? There was this sense of who have, one, done a lot of bad things, but two, those who have recognized how much they have been forgiven for. And we need to live back in that moment. Not to live in like, oh, I'm horrible and I, you know, whatever. But to live in a recognition of what I am now in contrast to who I would be without Christ. Right? To live in that freedom to say, wow, look at me. And you might see like, I've been a pretty good person all my life. Okay, well, the spectrum of a, you know, infinitely good God, no, you haven't. But even if you had, it still doesn't, you know, think about who you would be without him. Think about his goodness in this world that has kept things as good, you know, with all the suffering, how he has keep working to bring humanity back into alignment, how hell is the absence of God, and how worse would we be off if God just took his presence away from us. He is constantly trying to call us into this place of deeper community and unity with him. But we need to meditate on how much we have been forgiven by Christ. I think that's why John, looking at the cross, could not write his gospel without saying, I am the man who Christ loved. Because he kept looking at himself and remembering that memory of looking at Christ on the cross and thinking, this is how much. This is how much. The teachability. Third, we need to be teachable. Are we teachable? Are you teachable with your small group leader? Are you teachable with your resource leader? Are you teachable with your professor or your boss? Are you someone who is teachable? It's the same thing like honor. Teachability is something that says, I need you for something, and I want to surrender my pride to say, I will let you teach me. Are we teachable? Or are we people who are constantly saying, I know, I get it. So one thing about teachability, don't just sit back. Sometimes this is my thing. Like, I'll sit back and be like, I'll let you teach me, but I'm just going to kind of sit back, chill, and pretend like nothing's going on. And you know, you'll never know that you're teaching me, but I'm going to just sit here and chill. Are you actually engaging? Are you asking good questions? When was the last time you asked somebody in authority in your life a good question? A great question. It should be every day, every week, you know. I think I did last month maybe once. So I don't know. Maybe it wasn't a good question. You need to be teachable means you need to seek out asking good questions. Leaders might not even always have the answers, but there is amazing. I've learned this in my faith and my journey of walking with college students, that there is something that happens when I walk into something humbly and they walk into something humbly, and people start asking questions, it's like God shows up because he's like, here's a space that I can work. Here is soil that is soft, and I'll move. Fourthly, leadability. Are you leadable? We say it this way sometimes, it is healthy to bow, which simply means it is healthy to surrender my rights to someone else. I remember some years ago, I was in the Middle East with a few other Chi Alpha directors, and we were touring around with this leader for a missions area in that part of the world, in the Middle East. And he made this comment about this guy, Dick Brogdon. And Dick, at that time, was this kind of big up-and-coming missionary in that part of the world, been doing things that totally changed the game in that part of the world, arguably the most influential missionary at that moment, cross denominational lines in that part of the world. And this guy, Mark, was technically his boss. And I will never forget what Mark said about Dick. He said, I'm technically, I'm over like, I can't remember how many missionaries, it was like a couple hundred, I think, 200, 250 missionaries. And he said, you know who's the easiest missionary to lead? He said, Dick Brogdon is the easiest missionary to lead. The most influential, the most powerful, the most capable missionary in the Middle East was the one easiest to lead. Now, the world would say it should be the opposite. He doesn't need this leader. He has his own vision. He seems to have something that's working. He doesn't need to submit to anybody else. He just needs to do his own thing. But here is Dick, and I think there is something of a kingdom principle in here, that when he was willing to surrender his rights, bow to his authority, to say, what would you have me do? How can I help you in your vision? How can I do this with you in this authority that was this guy needed to sometimes make decisions that Dick had to submit to? And he did so easily. I think God was able to bless him, and he was the most influential missionary in that part of the world. Because, not despite, but because he was leadable. Are we leadable? I think, just in close, the worship team, you guys can come back up, but I think, for our community, I just want us to always remember that our goal is to really pursue hard after Christ. And humility is one of those things that is just foundational to that. And it's amazing when we suddenly come to this place where everything else starts to open itself up after that. And many of the great patriarchs through history had to come to this place of finding humility. That whether it's Peter, who is self-focused and self-aggrandizing, and suddenly became very scared when he was in fear of losing his life, later was humbled and became this great bold man. Whether it's David, who was called to be this great man and left for years of obscurity, Moses, who kind of recognized he was kind of a big deal, trying to step into it, failed miserably, left for the desert for years, came back, almost went the other way. He kind of did the two extremes of the cultural perception. I am a big deal. I'm nothing. God came in and said, hey, just walk with me. Just walk with me. Just let's do this together. Because as you start to see yourself through my eyes, you're going to start to realize it's not about your capacities or your abilities or your lack thereof. It's about my abilities to work through you. And if you'll just humble yourself, I can work miracles in your life. And I want that. I want that for you.
Yeah.
I want God to work the miraculous. Yeah. I want God to flow into your life and through your life into this world in a way you've never known or experienced or understood. I think it's so fascinating that we're this strange hybrid of creation. Some people will call it the angel animal paradox. We are both, this animal. We are this creature. We're DNA. We're mammals. We're all that kind of thing. Yeah, we got that, and we're this kind of metaphorically angel, eternal, made in the image of God, being, and we are this strange hybrid of creation. Because we were meant to be this place where we flew, the glory of God flowed through us into the world. And the worship and the praise of God flowed back to him.
Yeah.
That we were meant to be this place where the spiritual and the physical met. Unlike in our Western way of thinking where we think that the two are so separated, so disconnected, that they're totally different concepts. The ancient Jewish mind thought that they were actually deeply, closely connected. And that heaven was coming, kind of bringing the two together. And there's even these hints at it, even now, these places they're called temple. And when the New Testament starts saying, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit, you are the place where the spiritual and the physical start to merge and start to flow. Yeah. But it only comes when we are surrendered, consecrated is the way the Bible talks about it. When we are consecrated to the Lord, and the consecrated concept is that we are humbly saying, I am simply yours.
Yeah.
God, I am simply yours. I am your vessel.
Yes.
I am your instrument.
Yes.
And the way that the power of God can flow in me to transform me and through me to affect my world. When I suddenly say, God, it's not me. And not to say the same thing again, but John, I just can't imagine what it must have been like for him.
Yeah.
Thinking of himself, not good enough, not sufficient. But Jesus came up to him and said, the world may have said you weren't good enough for this, but I say you can.
Yeah.
With me, you can.
Amen.
Will you walk with me?
Yeah.
Will you journey with me? I'll change your destiny.
Come on.
And then him on the cross saying, who is this man? In reflection on his life, saying how great a gift I was given because he died
for
me.
Yes.
And how that changed so much of his sense of self that it was filled not by the exhausting, painful process of trying to boast myself up to something great that nobody even cares about because everybody else is trying to do the same thing, but to let go of that wasteful energy and to say, I'm just going to focus on the Lord. I'm just going to focus on his filling of myself, my sense of self, my value. What an amazing gift that is. So let's stand and let's do our part of that process of saying, not only am I letting God flow through me, but I am taking, God, what you have done, and as we go into worship, God, who you are and what you have done, I am worshiping you in response. I am loved. I am changed. I am transformed. And God, you have done such amazing things.